We begin with a continuation of a discussion on reconstruction operations. On Tuesday, we featured a conversation on the program with Iraq Reconstruction Special Inspector General Stuart Bowen and Afghanistan Reconstruction Special IG Arnold Fields that was recorded at the Brookings Institution. On lessons learned from rebuilding Iraq, you can listen to that discussion anytime you want on demand at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The RAND Corporation is focused on this issue as well. They have a new report, which is called Improving Capacity for Stabilization and Reconstruction Operations. Olga Oliker is a senior international policy analyst at RAND. She is one of the authors of the study. And, ma'am, I'd like to welcome you into the program today. Thanks for being on.
Thank you very much for having me.
What is the basic thesis of this report in a nutshell, and then we'll expand out from there?
Well, in a nutshell, we wanted to take a look at the broad range of things that had come out in recent years looking at how to improve capacity for stabilization and reconstruction operations with a focus on thinking about, okay, so what does that mean? What kind of framework can you put in to really guide efforts to take the necessary steps? I mean, there's just so much paper out there on this topic. Sorting through it and coming up with some assessments of our own of what we think of some of the recommendations that have been put out there, what we think of what's been going on, what we think is the art of the possible, and then just putting it together in a relatively short report. And our focus fundamentally is that you really do need to think about how to improve deployable civilian capacity, that one of the problems has been that it's the military that ends up doing this because they are so easy to deploy, but they're not usually the right tool for the job. They do a decent job because they have to, but there are problems associated with using military forces for a lot of these tasks. So a big part of this question is how to do this right is how do you develop this deployable civilian capacity?
I'm glad you didn't waste any time getting to that word because I saw that so many places in this report, and it's something I want to expand on as we progress through this discussion. I want to ask you first, though, you talked about going through the various papers and reports and so on that are out there on this subject. Did you find much of a consensus among those as you were sorting through all of them, or is there still a fairly wide diversity of opinion?
Actually, there's a pretty strong consensus that civilian capacity is necessary, that there is a giant police-shaped and sized gap in capabilities, and that that something needs to be done. Fundamentally, a lot of the reports, a lot of the writing goes in those directions. There's disagreement on various specifics. There's disagreement on how you go about doing these things. But I think actually a consensus has emerged over the years that's fairly impressive.
In this report, you have put together a list of specific capacity requirements. I'd like to just kind of highlight a couple of those and encourage anybody interested in learning more to go to federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, where we'll have a link up so to go right to the RAND website so you can look at this report for yourself. But you talk about policing and the rule of law, and you write, stabilization operations require deployable civilian police trainers, and judicial and corrections experts, and you've already gotten, as I said, to the word deployable. Tell me what deployable is. Is it deployable in the military sense, or is there another connotation to it?
Well, it's not deployable in the military sense because you cannot tell civilians that they have no choice but to go somewhere. You can give them jobs that imply that, you know, a big part of their job is to be willing to go when they want, you know, when you want them to go, but mm-hmm. they always have the right to quit those jobs. The point is to actually have a core of people who are available. Now, when you talk about the police capacity, one of the things that has been done recently is increased in using the military for this, is increased use of military police, and also some effort has been made, or at least talked about using National Guard personnel with some policing experience. And, you know, in those cases, if they're military, presumably you could just call them up and send them out. The problem is that MPs aren't quite the right folks for the job because training and building security force, internal security forces in a foreign country isn't exactly aligned with core mission tasks of the military police. And utilizing National Guard and Reserves is a problem because of the damage it does to existing units and their ability to deploy effectively. And also there's some question as to whether you'd actually cough up enough police to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're talking about with deployable police and trying to have kind of a core group is something the United Nations has tried to do with CivPol. Fundamentally, what it is, it's people you pull on, right? So you send out a call and you hope you get enough. And that has not generally gone sufficiently. It's very hard for operations like Iraq and Afghanistan to get enough police doing it that way. So the question is, what do you need? Do you need a bigger pool? Do you need people to commit more strongly to being available? How do you work that with local and state police organizations whom these guys might and gals might work for?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the issues in figuring out how to get this right.
You write about military and intelligence training and capacity building. Both of these efforts require effective civilian and political oversight. That's pretty self-explanatory, and appropriate levels of transparency. In a transitional environment, as no doubt someone would find him or herself in a stabilization and reconstruction operation, as you write about, what is an appropriate level of transparency? How can you tell what needs to be seen by others at the same time you're just trying to deal with a really potentially chaotic situation?
Well, a lot of it is just coordination, right? I mean, I actually think that when you're developing a training plan for military, police, intelligence personnel, it's not too much to ask that that plan be available to appropriate civilians and non-intelligence personnel, so the political leadership, so that they can vet it and make sure that it tracks with broader U.S. policy goals. I mean, I think that's actually a clear necessity, and I think that's, you know, something that sometimes is missing, kind of the stovepiping that occurs where everybody goes their own way and there isn't sufficient coordination. The question of how much transparency you want for the broader public, well, I would actually argue that in the country you're operating, it's important for the local people to know what's going on, what the plan is, what they're getting for having the U.S. Involved. So keeping them abreast of planning, of operations, of what exactly the goals are and how well you're meeting them, I don't think that's too much to ask either.
Another issue is governance, democratization, and human rights. And we come back to this concept of deployable. Relevant expertise exists throughout the U.S. government, but not in a deployable form. Maybe now is not the best time to discuss this because you write about it in a little bit more depth, and we'll go into that in just a little bit. But I kind of can't help myself. You said that there are lots of areas of expertise all over the federal government. Transitioning that knowledge, getting that to people who are willing to be deployable and able to be deployable, do you think that's the biggest challenge? Is that the hardest part of this?
That and kind of getting the government on one page on who's doing what, how they're doing it together, how it all aligns with broader goals. I think those are the big issues. But I actually think the police issue might be harder than that. I think it's plausible and possible to get a decent pool of experts from within and outside the U.S. government for these issues who are willing to go out when needed. It is harder to pull on police, I think, in many cases.
My guest is Olga Oelker, a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and one of the authors of the report that we're discussing, Improving Capacity for Stabilization and Reconstruction Operations. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We'll be back on In Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose, and my guest is Olga Oelker, a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and one of the authors of the report, Improving Capacity for Stabilization and Reconstruction Operations. You'll find it linked up later this afternoon on the In-Depth page on federalnewsradio.com. And thank you again for being on the program today.
Glad to be here.
We are talking about this report, and one of the things that you've done, which is a tremendous service to somebody like me who's coming to this not completely cold, but not with a terribly deep history on it, is to talk about efforts to build capacity, some of the things that the government's already tried to do. Talk about the Office of the Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization at the State Department, what the gist of that operation is, and essentially your findings on how they've done so far at doing so.
Okay, so the Office of the Coordinator for something that was developed formally by NSPD 44, but actually was in process before that. The idea was that you would have within the State Department an office that would be in charge of these operations, coordinating, leading U.S. government efforts to plan, prepare, and conduct stabilization and reconstruction. And the problem that occurred was that the office was set up, but there wasn't a real sense of who was going to be in charge, and there wasn't a lot of resourcing for that office to actually get it up and moving. So it ended up carrying out planning efforts in support of relevant State Department regional bureaus, chief of missions, and the military ended up continuing to do a lot of stabilization and reconstruction work. Now, over time, SCRS became kind of more effective as an actor within the bureaucracy, but it's still, you know, one of the problems has remained that you still don't have the folks to send out, right? So SCRS can identify states at risk of instability. It can develop contingency plans. It can do that sort of thing, but in terms of actually sending people out, there's a bit of a gap. Now, one of the ways that has been thought up to fill that gap is the idea of the Civilian Response Corps, which is part of a broader concept for the Civilian Stabilization Initiative. So the idea is that you'll have kind of a three-component group, which is an active component with about 250 full-time U.S. government personnel from the relevant departments and agencies who are in principle available to deploy within 48 hours. At the time we wrote the report, there were about 8 people who had deployed in this way to various locations. In addition to that, though, you'd have about 2,000 people on standby mm-hmm. who also belong to the agencies and could be deployable within 30 days for periods of up to 6 months. So it's not kind of their full-time job to be deployable,
right,
but they can be pulled on. And then finally, you have another 2,000 people from the private sector and state and local governments who have skills that maybe the federal government doesn't have, who are also available for deployment. Now, the problem is that it's been a long time funding. We've only just started to fund the stabilization initiative. So while agencies, you know, have been seconding their own staff and trying to fill the slots that way, it's really very important to get this to work to fund it fully. And that's one of our recommendations, that this be funded and that this be a priority.
And that kind of then answers my next question, which is, what do you think of that model? I imagine if you're advocating that it be funded and be able to then be put fully into practice, that it's a model that you believe will work well once they get the resources they need.
Right. It's an important start. It's not the solution in and of itself. The other thing that we recommend, you know, when you look at what civilian government agencies do have capacity to deploy at need and to dangerous locations, USAID does that a lot just on a smaller scale. And if you look at what USAID does, its tasks and its missions track very well with a lot of the key stabilization and reconstruction missions. Indeed, reconstruction is a large part of what USAID does. So looking at USAID capabilities and the State Department capabilities and looking at to the NSC to coordinate things overall, I think is the other important component of getting this moving, of understanding kind of what you need, who's available, how to get them out there. Because, you know, in the end, having a little over 4,000 people is going to be enough for some cases. Possibly not enough in others, particularly if you have significant needs simultaneously. And, of course, of the two reserves within the government and outside of the government, not everybody's going to be available at any given time. So it's actually a lot less than 4,000 people. So, and not all of them are going to be relevant to any given mission, right? So it's not as though they're plug and play everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, there remain issues to be sorted out, but I do think overall it's an important first step.
We just have a few moments before the break, about a minute to go before I have to take a break. I would like to have you come back and kind of give us a wrap up on it. But before we get to the break, do you think the way that USAID does it now is structured in such a way that that would be replicable and expandable, that it could be multiplied and still work on a larger scale?
Well, I think it's a starting point. What USAID does now is not specifically this, and you'd need to consider how you would need to manage and adjust it in concert with the State Department, with the oversight of the NSC, working with other agencies. The other issue to be considered, particularly in high-risk environments, is the safety and security of civilian staff. And that has also been a stumbling block for some of this is, you know, you might have people who are willing to deploy, but they don't have freedom of movement once they get there because of security concerns.
Olga Oehlicher is a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, one of the authors of the report, Improving Capacity for Stabilization and Reconstruction Operations. And we'll come back and wrap up our discussion with her in just a moment on In Depth with Frances Rose. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're back on In Depth with Frances Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Olga Oehlicher, a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and one of the authors of Improving Capacity for Stabilization and Reconstruction Operations, a new report that is out from the RAND Corporation. And this report, as all work from the RAND Corporation does not just point out the problems and highlight some of the good things that are happening. It offers recommendations and solutions to some of the issues, and I'd like to go through those just for a few moments if we could. The first is emphasize civilian rather than military capabilities. How does this comport with what Secretary Gates has talked about, Ms. Oehlicher, as far as soft power compared to hard power?
Actually, I think it aligns very nicely with what Secretary Gates, Secretary Clinton, and Vice President Biden have been talking about for soft power, about kind of leading with the civilian side. The military has really taken on a lot of kind of the concept that this stuff is important, but if you read military doctrine, it emphasizes that the military should be in a support role on these, that there should be a civilian lead. The problem has been getting the civilians out there to lead and to take on the important tasks. You know, there's this fundamental agreement across the board that civilians should be doing this, but there's a gap of actual civilians to get out there and do it. And I think that that's really the important thing to fill, because otherwise we all will agree that we're doing it wrong.
Another issue for another recommendation is to realign the National Security Council, State Department, and USAID roles. We've talked a little bit about the role of USAID and in the last segment. We've talked a little bit about the State Department's role as well. Talk about the National Security Council, how they fit into this, what they should be responsible for, and then how that will affect the way that state and USAID have been involved in these situations.
Well, the job of the National Security Council is to coordinate policy among the various agencies. But so you know that a lot of folks have suggested it actually should be the NSC that's in charge of all of this. But the NSC does not do things. The NSC helps direct agencies to do things, help us ensure that they work together. So our feeling was that rather than creating new capacities in the NSC or even creating new government structures, as some folks have suggested, is actually we have these capabilities, we just aren't drawing on them effectively. So part of the NSC's job will be to figure out how to draw effectively on what's available in state, USAID, and other departments as relevant. But it's not the NSC's job to do the task themselves.
Mm-hmm. They'll be the clearinghouse in a way, a manner of speaking.
The coordinator. Coordinator, the guidance. They are the office of the president, so they provide the guidance.
All right. Another recommendation is to fund and implement the Civilian Stabilization Initiative. We've talked about that one. You also mentioned that it's important to improve deployable police capacity, and that word comes up again, deployable. You write the National Guard and Reserves and urban search and rescue teams may be able to serve as models.
Right. We have some models available for how you pull on police for when needed. And I think it's actually really important to study what we've done in the past. Also to look at how other countries do it when they have to deploy police. Look at UN CIVPOL models. Look at kind of the wealth of what's out there and apply it to the United States. You know, think about what you can offer police forces for making people available. Make sure that they're resourced appropriately so they don't end up with gaps when they support national missions, that sort of thing.
Improved management for stabilization and reconstruction, and you and your colleagues write the State Department USAID have focused on improving day-to-day and strategic management, but they've paid less attention to crisis management. Are there other resources within the federal government that you found that might help them with that?
Well, we think that USAID is actually in a very good place for that because they do a certain amount of crisis response. We also feel that part of the management issue is kind of have a streamlined approach, understand what the tasks are. So by identifying missions, building up the capacity that needs to be built up, and then using it once you've got it, planning for the missions, both with the resources that you have at any given time and the resources you hope to have in the future, and understanding the difference, managing the missions once they're launched. SCRS has put a lot of effort into thinking it through how to do that, but, you know, you then have to move from concept to reality. So all of that put together, it is going to be a question of how you effectively manage in crises, which means you need a blueprint, and you also need to know how you might diverge from the blueprint in the event.
All right. And the final recommendation is to ensure coherent guidance and funding for effectiveness and sustainability. It really does come down to resources, ultimately, like many issues that the government faces.
Guidance and resources. It needs to be clear that this is a priority. It needs to be clear that this is how we're going to go about doing it. And then the money needs to be matched up with it. That's absolutely true, which requires an executive legislative partnership to allocate the resources, to ensure that they're available, and to ensure that the right people can get their hands on them. What we've been doing in the past few years is doing things like moving money from DOD to the State Department. You know, so it's initially part of the defense budget, and it gets shifted over. That's not an effective mechanism for doing this, and it doesn't necessarily send the right signals about whose responsibility all of this is.
All right. To implement these recommendations, Ms. Oliker, what is step one, or maybe steps 1, 2, and 3 to begin to get us to a situation where you and your colleagues believe we should be as far as improving this capacity?
Well, there are a number of steps that kind of need to be undertaken simultaneously. One, the very first is kind of a senior level commitment to an approach, whether it's specifically our approach or a variation of some of the other ideas that have been put out there, but one that actually identifies who's in charge, how they're in charge, how they work with others, what everybody's responsibilities are. The other is working with Congress to make sure that the money gets there. And then the third is really thinking through the issues that aren't resolved, such as the police question. Developing plans, developing approaches, vetting them through, and getting the agreements in place that you need to make this work.
The good news that I took away as I read through this report and that you seem to have confirmed during our conversation is that for pretty much all of these recommendations that you're making, there are models in place. There are best practices that are very readily available. There are people that have the knowledge and should be fairly accessible to implement it and so forth. So the tools are pretty much right at hand, if I'm not mistaken.
I think a lot of them are, but that doesn't necessarily make it easy. There's a reason that there are reasons we've had such a hard time doing this up until now. So, you know, I would not be complacent that just because it can be done, it will be done. It will require leadership and it will require resourcing.